Furthermore, there was really no attempt ever made to elaborate any fundamental law, any basic constitutional principle which could overrule the royal prerogative. Instead, the Parlement simply claimed, in a fairly time-honored and traditional fashion, that the Parlement's authority to oppose the crown actually came from the crown itself. And another way to put this is that the argument of the Parlement of Paris is really like an argument from inferior magistrates. It's not an argument from popular sovereignty in which a court rallies the people. It's rather an argument from the inferior magistrates' argument in which the machinery of the state corrects its own mistakes without appealing to any sovereignty or source of authority outside itself. It is certainly true, I think we have to say, that the Parlement was happy, wanted indeed, to expand its own power. It would very much have liked to reduce the power of its opponents, in particular these intendants, these royal officials, with whom the crown had done so much in the early 17th century. And yet I think what is striking about the Parlement of Paris is that for all its superficial radicalism, this same court would actually fairly quietly accept the fact that the monarchy would ultimately repudiate the Rouen Agreement of 1649 after 1652, when Louis XIV was a legal adult. And the Parlement said almost nothing about this. It was very quiet about this erosion of the concessions that had been made to it in the 1649 agreement. Why, I think we need to ask, did the Parlement of Paris do so? I mean, how do we explain the fact that a court can go from saying we want to, you know, abolish the intendants, audit the accounts of the king's books, supervise royal taxation, claim all of these powers, ultimately, you know, declare the chief minister of the king an enemy of the state and raise an army against him, and yet then, having been given all these concessions, quietly do nothing when the crown later goes back on its promises? It seems to me that there are a number of reasons that are worth stressing. First of all, the crown was politically careful. It respected the legitimacy of many of the magistrates' criticisms. And above all, the crown satisfied the most urgent demand of the Parisian justices, and that was the renewal of the Paulette. That was, you'll recall, the financial proposal which had sent the ballistic in the first place, this effort to undermine the heritability of the offices. And the crown backpedaled on that, let the offices remain heritable, and that really took a lot of the anger out of the criticism of the parlementaires. Moreover, the crown also began, although I think we have to say they did this extremely slowly, to honor its financial obligations. The crown slowly began to resume payment of salaries or gage to the venal officers, and it also began slowly to resume payment of interest on the royal bonds, the so-called rentes, on which it depended for war finance. In other words, it seems to me that we can say that the Parlement of Paris accepted the erosion of the Rouen Agreement and all the concessions that had been implicit therein, because the Parlement had never really intended to overthrow the crown in the first place. And this is clear, it seems to me, from its ideology itself. The revolt of the judges, I think we have to say, was motivated not so much by a desire to overthrow the absolutist state and replace it by some kind of constitutional regime. Instead, it was motivated by a desire to protect the position which the Parlement of Paris and the other judicial officials had within the absolutist state. In other words, it was an argument for improving their position inside the machinery of the state rather than wanting to overthrow that machinery as a whole. To sum up, then, this lecture on the Fronde of the Parlement, this kind of resistance by the judicial officers of the French crown during 1648-49, has reviewed the resistance by the magistrates of these senior law courts to what we might want to call the French fiscal military state, that is to say, a state whose primary consideration is fighting wars, in this case the 30 Years' War and the war against Spain, and the fiscal tag comes in because the other concern of the state when fighting all these wars is how to pay for these wars. We've seen what the nature of that resistance was, and I think one way to sum it up is that it was both spectacular and it was paradoxical at the same time. The resistance of the judges was spectacular just because of the degree to which they were, at least at their acme, willing to go, the kinds of claims they were willing to make against the French crown. But the resistance was also paradoxical because of what you might want to say the whimper with which it ended rather than the bang, the seeming acquiescence of the courts in the ultimate triumph of the monarchy. But the resolution to this paradox, it seems to me, is how we ought to conceptualize resistance itself. Is this an ideological conflict between interests which have diametrically opposed and irreconcilable visions of what the state ought to be? Or is it really more a more parochial or less dignified conflict between ins and outs, between people who feel that they ought to profit more from the machinery of the state? And these same tools, this contrast between an ideological conflict and a dispute between ins and outs, is going to be useful in analyzing the other malcontents of 17th century France, who we'll turn to in the next lecture, that is to say, the French aristocracy and the French peasantry.